Now it happened one day that Jonathan the son of Saul said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah, under a pomegranate tree which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod, but the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other Sine. The front of one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other southward opposite Gibeah. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of those uncircumcised. It may be that God, the Lord, will work for us. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few." So his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Go then, here I am with you according to your heart." And Jonathan said, "Very well, let us go cross over to these men, and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up. For the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us." So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden." Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, "Come up to us, and we will show you something." Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel." And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. And there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people, that the garrison and the raiders also trembled, and the earth quaked, so that it was a very great trembling. Now the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away, and they went here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, "Now call the roll and see who has gone from us." And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here," for at the time the ark of God was with the children of Israel. Now it happened, while Saul talked to the priest, that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle. And indeed, every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was very great confusion. Moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country. They also joined the Israelites, who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel, who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beth Avan. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under oath, saying, "Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening before I have taken vengeance on my enemies." So none of the people tasted food. Now all the people of the land came to a forest, and there was honey on the ground. And when the people had come into the woods, there was the honey, dripping. But no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father's charge and the people with the oath. Therefore he stretched out the end of the rod that was in his hand and dipped it into a honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his countenance brightened. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed is the man who eats food this day.'" And the people were faint. But Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. Look now how my countenance has brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found. For now would there not have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines?" Now they had driven back the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon. So the people were very faint, and the people rushed on the spoil and took sheep, oxen, and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, "Look, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." So he said, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a large stone to me this day." Then Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, 'Bring me here every man's ox and every man's sheep. Slaughter them here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood.' So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night and slaughtered it there." Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. This was the first altar that he built to the Lord. Now Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." Then the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." So Saul asked counsel of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you deliver them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him that day. And Saul said, "Come over here, all you chiefs of the people, and know and see what this sin was today. For as the Lord lives, who saves Israel, thought it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But not a man among all the people answered him. Then he said to all Israel, "You be on one side, and my son Jonathan and I will be on the other side." And the people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Therefore Saul said to the Lord God of Israel, "Give a perfect lot." So Saul and Jonathan were taken, but the people escaped. And Saul said, "Cast lots between my son Jonathan and me." So Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." And Jonathan told him and said, "I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand, so now I must die." Saul answered, "God do so much and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." But the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die, who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Certainly not. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Then Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. So Saul established his sovereignty over Israel and fought against all his armies on every side, against Moab, against the people of Ammon, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he harassed them. And he gathered an army and attacked the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. The sons of Saul were Jonathan, Jeshui, and Malchishua. And the names of his two daughters were these: the name of the firstborn, Merab, and the name of the younger, Michal. The name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now there was fierce war with the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he he took him for himself.
That was 1 Samuel chapter 14. Before I begin my little spiel, there are some odd things. I know it was a relatively long chapter. I know we also actually covered the first three verses the last time I was up here, just because it was such a long chapter. But I had him read it again as well, because it doesn't hurt to read it. Any questions or comments? Things that caught your attention? Something that didn't quite make sense to you? That I can, yes, Bill.
Why did John rebel? He didn't hear the command of the
We're going to get into that. There are rules regarding regarding kings. When a ban is instilled, there are rules regarding ignorance and non-ignorance. We'll be able to get into a small amount of that today. Ignorance is not an excuse. Much like our current law system, just because you didn't know the law is not a reason why you shouldn't have to obey it. Our laws, and all the millions we have, are no different than what the king's laws were written. You're right. You can't keep it, but that doesn't mean you're not liable for it. It's we'll get into that, and it's supported by the Torah. That just because you don't know a law doesn't mean you're not liable for it. Dave.
The thing I like to be reminded of, the word ignorance, the root word is ignore.
Yes, it is ignore. And we'll actually get a small amount of that today. Did Jonathan ignore anything? We'll have to see. Yes, Tammy.
There's one pattern that you see over and over again in this particular chapter. When it goes between the people and Saul, it's like when Saul does something, the people, for most of the chapter, they say, do what you see fit, or whatever your translation might say. But only when he's getting ready to execute Jonathan for breaking a command that really has nothing to do with Torah. The Torah specifically says what kind of things are punishable by death, and eating honey isn't one of them.
Right.
But up to this point, you know, through the whole chapter, they're willing to follow Saul in his direction. Do whatever you see fit. But when it came to Jonathan, then all of a sudden...
Wait a minute. Yeah, we're going to intervene here. And we'll discuss that a little bit as well. Yes, they intervened, and for all exterior accounts, it seemed that they did the right thing, which we'll discuss what actually is right and what is not right. Keep in mind, this is prophet's section. This is not Torah. People are people. They do whatever they're going to do. They don't necessarily follow laws. Just because laws are given to them doesn't mean they always follow them. I mean, name any one of us who haven't broken a law. Honestly. Just because they're there doesn't mean you follow them. So, right or wrong, these guys and the people, they do what they're going to do, and we're just recording what they actually have done. So, any other comments or questions? Yes, Pat.
What is the connection between Jonathan's eating the honey and then the people falling on the spoil and eating the food with the blood?
With the blood, yes. We'll get into it. It has almost all to do with Saul's command as to why that occurred and why it is that Jonathan anticipated that that was going to be the result once he heard what the decree was. That it would have been much greater had it not been done this way, but because the command... bad things happened. we'll get there when we get there, unfortunately. I can't get there until I reach that point in the chapter. Any other comments or questions? Yeah, I don't know your first name. What was it again? Sharon. Yes, Sharon.
I've always loved the first part of this chapter.
It's a beautiful first part.
Jonathan and one of his armor bearer going up, I think, is there one sword?
Normally it'd be one sword, but the armor bearer would have a miniaturized knife about, 12 to 18 inches long.
Instead of putting out a fleece that would their fleece to the Lord was kind of like, okay, if they say come up here, then that's our sign.
Let's go do it. It shows a great heart that Jonathan had. That's why I liken him to David's heart. They're very similar in their personalities. When David goes to battle, it's not a, okay, let's consult the ark as Saul did. David's like, yeah, let's go do it. Yeah. Goes, does it. It's a very profound, bold personality. And that's one of the reasons why David and Jonathan were such good friends, because they were two peas in a pod. They're very similar people. Any other questions or comments? Okay, just go right into this then. As I mentioned before, this is a two-part thing. We covered the first part of chapter 13 the last time I was up here, which we covered a few things here and there. And granted, there were a few comments which I was unable to get to then, and unfortunately I probably won't get to them today either, from chapter 13. But we had discussed last time, because we've read the first two verses, I'll reiterate a few of the minor items we pointed out the last time. A few chapters ago, Eli made his mistakes. He made his, chapter, I forgot, it's like 11 or 10, something like that. He made his mistakes to his sons. God commanded, you, your descendants, will no longer be priests. I will kill you off. And from that point on, as mentioned many times already, they have documented evidence of his descendants dying prematurely, dying very young ages. Roughly around the age of 40 was the one of the few ages they reached. They have a record of one man after Eli living up to 60, but all the rest of them were dead very, very young. So how is it the high priest, a descendant of Eli, is here carrying the ark when God said, you will not be part of the priesthood anymore? How is this possible? Notice it points out his lineage, in case you didn't catch that again. It says it's Ichabod's brother, Atub, the son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the Kohen, who God said, Eli, you, your sons, they will be dead. You will not be high priest from this point forward. But yet, Atub is. As I mentioned last time, the high priesthood stopped. It froze in place once the Ark of the Covenant was taken and Shiloh, the temple, was destroyed. The priesthood isn't doing anything anymore that they used to do. Yes, they still exist, meaning that the lineage of human beings didn't all die off. But they're actually not functioning as high priests anymore. They're functioning in just as priests in general. There's a little difference. I know it seems subtle, but it actually isn't subtle. A high priest has a lot more rules they must obey because they require a temple to function. The temple here is gone. It's been gone for, at this point, upwards about 12 to 15 years. It's been destroyed. They're not around anymore. But the high priest didn't disappear. But when David reinstills, when he recreates this temple God, and brings God back, he dictates, all right, high priesthood, you will now start at this point forward. And of course, he does not choose any lineage from Eli. Much like he was supposed to. Once the temple is reestablished, God now has his high priests again. Atub, Eli, all these guys are gone. They're vanished from history. They are not even recorded in the lineage of high priests in the Chronicles. They're not there. As far as God's concerned, they never existed. That's what happens when you cause the people to sin in such an egregious manner that Eli and his sons did. So, yes, he's here right now because he's still alive. The temple has not been rebuilt. These people still exist. They still have access to the ark until David comes along and says, okay, now we're going to build you a home, and now go away. And thus they go away. Okay, now let's get the fun part. I like Jonathan. I think he's a great guy. Unfortunately, because, in my opinion, just my humble opinion, because he was related to Saul, he was not allowed to be king. I think he would have been a great king, much like how David was. Maybe not quite like David, but very similar. Unfortunately, that's just not the case. Lineage will kill you sometimes. So, Jonathan leaves the 600 men away. He says, oh, let's go off the Arbiter. Now, Jonathan, the previous chapter, he's the one who instigated this entire war, this entire battle scene. He goes off to Gibeah and says, all right, he's got 1,000 men with him. But he goes over to the governor, the garrison, the leader, the guys in charge, takes his sword and runs him through. And then leaves him there. And then walks. As if it's no nonchalant, no big deal. I killed a bad guy. Yeah, he's been here for however many years. I don't really care. He's dead. That's the kind of heart Jonathan has. He doesn't care whether or not it's acceptable to the people, how difficult it may or may not be. It was more of, God doesn't like this person. Much how like David would have treated him. Let's go kill him. Okay, done. Very simple. A very blunt and bloody individual. He's not afraid of killing a few. So he starts this whole thing. He gets all the Philistines all riled up. Oh no, our governor's died. Let's go kill all the Israelis. Israelites. Sorry, that's not Israelis yet. Israelis is a modern term. Kill all the Israelites. Unfortunately, the translation that Dave read is slightly sanitized for our sensibilities in what we don't like to hear, which we'll get to there when we reach that point. But we'll just start into it a little bit now. When the Philistines, if they're your commanders, they're the people who are in charge of you, you like them or not, doesn't make much difference. When Jonathan slaughtered this guy, in this previous chapter 13, Shofar was blasted, everybody's, oh, quick, alarm, alarm, alarm. Either flee, which is perfectly acceptable, come to battle, which is also acceptable, or stay where you're at, which is also acceptable. You can do whatever you want, as long as you are aware of what has happened. So whatever happens now, from this point forward, you didn't get caught unaware. Unfortunately, those who stay where they are at are likely to get drafted in whatever army is occupying you. And contrary to the slight wording which his thing says, his book says, there were Israelites in the Philistine army that were there to kill their fellow Israelites. They are killers, by the way. They're all trained to do military stuff, nothing fancy there. And no, this is not abnormal. If those of you who recall what happened to the tribe of Benjamin, the Israelite men don't really care if they kill their brethren, if it's for the right cause, as far as they're concerned. So yeah, they went off, they slaughtered almost the entire tribe of Benjamin. Remember what happened to Ephraim and Jephthah? They were upset. Hey, how come you didn't bring us to the battle? Let's go to war and we'll kill you. And Jephthah said, bring it on. And what happened? Ephraim lost horribly. Lost a lot of men. Jephthah slaughtered them. Yet they're all brethren. They're all brothers. So killing your brother is not unheard of in the Israelite culture. This is not abnormal. This is not liked, but it's not as if it isn't done. So being drafted into the Philistine army, whether you like the Philistines or not, and you're told to go to war, so you go to war. And yeah, you may kill the people who you once were friends with. That's the nature of it. Because what happens if you don't? You die, and most likely your whole family dies. You weigh your options. Yeah, buddy, you know, we used to grow up together. I apologize for this, but you are one man who dies. And I am one man who dies. If I kill you, okay. I'm sorry, but that's the way it works. However, if I don't kill you, or try to, we don't lose one man. We lose my whole family. So there's an incentive to obey the Philistine command. There are some Israelites inside the Philistine army, contrary to what it may appear to be. No offense to his little book, it's just that it just words it that way, and it's too bad it does. So they all go around, and okay, Jonathan disappears. There's down to 600 men, unfortunately, down to little Saul's tiny army, which, as I mentioned last time, yes, there are no swords, there are no spears, but what armies, what tools do they have to kill with? They have slings, they have bows and arrows, yes, they're probably a few axes, well, possibly an axe, they didn't have any sharpening abilities, so it's hard to say. They may have had wooden spears, I don't know, maybe rock spears. Slings. Now, slings, of course, are highly deadly instruments, contrary to our common thinking, oh, you know, a little throwing a small rock a short distance, whoop-de-doo. Well, how do you think the Huns killed the Roman Empire? They used bows and arrows and slings. And their own Roman army has no defense against it. This is how they did such mass devastation. Because the Huns had slings, and they were on horseback, by the way, so that had another advantage. And they're throwing these things, and it penetrates the pathetic little Roman armor that they once had, and slaughters them. And now, there are a lot of tools in the Roman ancient toolkit for the medics to remove rocks from the body, deep in the body, and hopefully not kill the soldier who's been hit by one. They penetrate quite deeply. Sorry, Bill, you had your hand up a second ago?
David and Goliath,
which is a great example. We're not there yet. We'll get there in a few chapters. Great example. You can kill a man with a rock. They're shepherd's slings. Yes, they don't seem like that impressive of a weapon. You can kill a man. You can kill a lot of things with a rock. They're designed to kill a lion on impact. That's what they're built for. You're a shepherd. You're out there with sheep. You have a rock. You sling it. You get one shot on a lion before he turns on you. It's designed to kill him on impact. So you got to throw a rock pretty darn hard to do that. So slings are pretty deadly. So they had them. Only 600 men, though. That's not very many compared to the estimated 600,000, I think, Philistines. There were huge amounts of Philistine army. And by the way, at this point in history, 1,000 actually means 1,000. Not, you know, a clan. It's actually 1,000 people. So they're actually normal count like we count, as opposed to families like they used to count. So 600 men are left. Saul's stressed out. Jonathan leaves. Jonathan. Ugh, what a great guy. So he goes up to his armor bearer. Let's cross over to this area. Now, by the way, those in case you're not aware of the battlefield here, Gilgal is located here along the Jordan River, just north of the Dead Sea. This is where most of the 600 men are living, or are at, in and around the area. It's the Valley of Achor. In case you don't remember, Achor is the guy who took from the garments of Jericho, and of course caused the death of, I forgot the exact number of Israelites, but in the next battle. So located here, Michmash, which is right about this little spot. I'm not, my map's not exactly perfect, but it's approximately. Now, that's where most of the Philistine army is located at. I say most because where are the rest of them? Well, the Philistine army has come over to go to battle. Now, Saul's been here in Gilgal for about approximately 7, possibly pushing 8 days, and no battle has taken place. What happens when you're an army all geared for war and you're sitting still for 8 days? Guys are crazy. You go on raiding parties. Woo! Alright, so they went up to Ophrah, raiding party. Bethel, raiding party. Bethaven was a raiding party. They went down to, I don't think they went down to Ahalon. But anyway, there were 3 raiding parties. One here, there, and actually went toward Gilgal. They're raiders. Small groups. 30, 40, 50 men will go out and just raid. Raid the local farms. Destroy things. What else are you going to do for almost eight days? You're designed to kill. You're even trained to kill. You got nothing else to do. Go kill. So what did Jonathan do? Well, Jonathan leaves Gilgal with the other 600 guys. The Michmash Pass is the place between Gilgal and Michmash. Big shock there. It's a small pass. It's not very large. But it's only a few passes you can get. There's a direct shot. There actually is much larger passes down here, the north end of the Dead Sea. Much broader, easier traveling area for armies to pass through. But it's the same pass that Joshua went through when they crossed over to Gilgal and went up to Ai, which is approximately here, and attacked that town. It's the same pass. It's a convenient, it's a relatively small area. He goes to this pass, of course, who did he run into? A raiding party of about 20 men. About the right size of a raiding party. And of course, he goes to armor bearer and goes off and they kill him. Now, let's back up a little bit, though, or let's talk about this a little bit. Is Jonathan challenging God with this statement? Now, some would say yes and some would say no. Now, here's the difficulty. If I go out and I go into local street and say, something important is happening in my life, whatever it is, it made a difference. I say, all right, God, if the next stoplight I come up to is green, then I'll go ahead and do this. If the next stoplight comes is red, I'll do whatever, something else. Is that not challenging God? Is it not testing Him? His ability to turn something green or red on time according to what I want? Difficult question to ask. Difficult question to answer, too. Most would say he's challenging God. Some would say he's not challenging God. He's just asking God for guidance. Which would then beg the question, is he asking for an omen, which is forbidden according to the Torah? A death penalty if you ask for an omen, in case you're curious. If you have a response, this is not an easy question. Hold on, Ellie, you can hear that first.
There are times to when you know the direction you're going, but you don't know what to do. And look at Gideon's fleece. He did not know
what to do.
And the only thing he could do, I've done it with a flipped coin. Okay, Father, I don't know the answer to this, and I have no way of knowing it. And whatever goes, that I'm gonna take that as the answer. So if I'm in trouble and I get the wrong, I'm gonna be in trouble. I'm gonna do it wrong. So please make it come out right. And I went by what was there, right or wrong.
Right or wrong. That's what you did by. Mm-hmm. Bill, your hand was up.
Yeah, I've heard the word omen. What's that?
An omen? A sign that is... cried. I don't know what the Greek definition of omen is. Yeah, it's an evil thing. It's designed asking like a spirit of something, like for example, a rock. For example, the spirit of this rock, please give me this an image or a vision as to what you are asking for. And then, of course, not just I hear it though. Omen is by multiple people around me can hear or understand the same event and come to the same conclusion. That's what it's used for. I don't know the correct definition in Greek, but that's the physical definition that I know it by. Yes, David.
Wait, they even cast lots.
Yes, the cast lots. Is that not also the same thing? It is, isn't it? Yes, Tammy.
Well, I think in Jonathan's situation and maybe some of these others, Jonathan knew that it was God's will that they go to battle against the Philistines, but he didn't know for sure if he was supposed to be the instrument of it or not.
Yes, that's true.
And yeah, so, right. You know, it's just him and this young man, and he's there now, and it's like, okay, this is now or never. If you do this, then I'll go. If you don't do this, then I'll just go back. I mean, the battle is a battle. The battle is yours. Mm-hmm. If I do it today, that's fine. If you want my dad to do it some other time, that's fine. The battle is yours. Do you want me to be the instrument or not?
I wish to submit to you an idea. You may not agree with it. I don't really care. Jonathan wasn't just asking for the sake of asking. Note, he was not asking for the sake of telling his armor bearer, oh, see, God's with us. Though he did tell him that. That was not the purpose of his ask. Jonathan's heart seemed to be, in my opinion, ever so humble it may be, it was to find out truly what God wanted, as opposed to what he necessarily wanted. You know what I'm saying? Saul does a similar type of things. Who raised Jonathan to do the same kind of thing. And that to not focus upon what you want, focus solely upon whatever the result may be, whether I know it, understand it, or not, makes no difference. It's, I believe, because Jonathan strikes me so similar to David, I think Jonathan's heart is exactly where it needed to be when he asked that question. Much like how Saul's heart is where it needs to be when he's asking for casting of the lots. He's not asking for the sake of asking. He's not asking for the sake of a miracle. He's asking solely because he needs guidance, and he's going to do something, whatever it may be. He sees what it is. Jonathan is relatively impulsive, much like how David is relatively impulsive. They will go do something. Whatever it is, God, I'm going to do it. And goes out and does it. It's a unique type of character, which I don't know if we're going to call us for any people who are quite that way. Not that they're not impulsive, is that at the moment in time that they need to be there, they are so in tune with God and what He needs and what He wants that they have no fear of asking Him and know He's going to get the answer right here and there. I know it's going to be His answer. Let's go do it. I'll worry about it when I get there. It's an abnormal characteristic trait. Saul doesn't have that trait, which we've read about. We'll talk more about it. He doesn't have that trait. It's not that I'm going to go do it anyway. Much like how Jonathan does. David has, I'm going to go do it anyway. Jonathan has, I'm going to do it anyway. Saul, not so much. He's a little bit reluctant on that. So that's why, in my personal opinion, when you're asking for a sign from God, in this case, in Jonathan's case, it's a sign from God, it's not how you ask it. It's not when you ask it. It's why you're asking it. And who you are when you ask. Because if you're not ready to hear precisely what is being told you, guess what? You're likely to get the wrong answer. And the example I gave to you earlier was the green light, the red light. I'll go do this, or I will go do something else. That's the wrong attitude. That's not the example that you would want when you're trying to discuss, when you're trying to talk to God. It is, all right, God, you're going to go do this. Or God, you're going to go do something else. Tell me which one it is, because I want to go do it. Not tell me which one I'm going to go do. It's tell me which one it is so I will go do it. And that I will do it because you're the one who's going to do it. I'm going to follow you. It's a different twist on how you are asking Him and what you're asking for. I apologize. Susan, you had your hand up a second ago.
No, I was just thinking it has overtones of what you would read about in battles of valiant soldiers.
It is.
Up against amazing odds, for example, on Iwo Jima, where a small group, totally outnumbered by the enemy, would sort of almost rise up in a valiant, righteous attitude, believing that
that God was with them,
that
yeah.
God would go with them, and kaboom, they attack, and kaboom,
and
they
it works. Kaboom. It's very much so. That's one of the reasons why I love battle scenes, and because it shows you the heart of the people who are actually in it. Very few times will you understand somebody's heart, what they're made of, until you find out what they do when their life is about to end. And their actions are right there, and they're right there doing it. It's a very unique opportunity to understand someone. Kathy, you had your hand up a second ago. Omens.
Against omens.
Omens, correct.
The general consensus, but the word, is because it's evil.
Right.
Righteous men do not seek
evil omens.
God.
That's very true, which is one of the things that got Saul in so much trouble shortly from now. Yes.
Jonathan was so, I see, just a trust. I mean, he obviously, like you said, knew that God was going to give him direction. If God said no, then he wouldn't have done it.
He'd done something else. Whatever it was that God chose him to do. In this case, God, he was there, he would have stayed there, most likely, as he said, stay, we'll stay. But, yes, it would have resulted in Jonathan being captured, most likely, but that's okay. If that was God's will, so be it. Because Jonathan, by the way, is the man who started this battle. If God wasn't pleased with him, this is a good opportunity to find out. He's the one who killed the governor. So if God would have rather him not do so, he could have chosen, all right, Jonathan, no, you're going to be captured. I didn't want this to happen this time. No, clearly that wasn't the case, fortunately for him and for all the rest of us. Let's see here. Okay. Now, of course, they used almost, not even verbatim, but very similar words to what Jonathan had spoke. Thus, of course, gives not only Jonathan the confidence to know that God's with him and he will deliver, it also gives his armor-bearer the confidence, okay, I'm not following a lunatic. We're going to go ahead and do this, and we're going to win. That's a beautiful thing to have in the middle of a battle, is confidence to succeed. So, of course, it's 20 men, roughly they kill 20 guys, between the two of them. My wording is slightly different than Dave's, but it's not significant. They both go up there. Jonathan kills the guys in front. His armor bearer kills the guys behind him. They're just back-to-back slaughtering whoever attacks. Apparently was extremely effective because they got 20 guys dead. The result, though, is fascinating. The Philistine army is enormous for any army at this point in time in history. It's phenomenally large. And if I recall, chapter 13, I think it rattled off the size. It along the lines of it was more than what any human could count. It was like the sands of the sea almost. 6,000 cavalries, as many foot soldiers as numerous as the sands of the sea, 30,000 chariots. This is a big army, just 600 men. 30,000. And by the way, in this case, at this time in history, 1,000 means 1,000, like we think of 1,000, not family, like we used to be back in the judges' time. So that's actually 30,000 chariots. Now, what's so unique about chariots? Foot soldiers will die when a chariot attacks. Why? Because the best a foot soldier can do is kill the horse. When a chariot's going so stinking fast, and there's usually more than one horse on a chariot, there's usually two, in the Roman case there was three, they'd run through and they slaughter a lot of people. The Roman chariots were a little bit unique. They had on their wheels rather wicked-looking objects that would protrude from the wheel. They just run through the foot soldiers and then kill anybody which the object, that's usually some wicked kind of blade, would attack or injure or kill. Very nasty items. One of the reasons why God said, you will not build chariots when he commanded his kings. You will not bring forth horses. You will not build chariots. You will not trust in them. You'll trust solely in me, which he gave the command to Joshua. Nasty items, 30,000 chariots, obviously cavalry, and of course foot soldiers, which we don't know the exact number. It's as the sands, the seashore, it could be, it's hard to say the exact number, but obviously there was a significant amount of them. Now, by the way, the sand of the seashore is a phrase used back in the Torah when it described the Israelites when they came out of Egypt. Guesstimates as far as the exact quantity of Israelites, somewhere around, they said 600,000 men.
That's what it's claimed. Now, we don't know how many 1,000 is for sure at that time, but it was a fairly large number. That's males. Yeah, you quadruple that for women, and of course, 2 children per family, it goes fairly large. And they were called the Sands of the Sea. So, and let's use the same phrase, a good chance for a similar type of number of people. Maybe not exact, but probably similar. Somebody had their hand up. Bill.
You gotta feed these guys.
Yeah. Hence the raiding parties. Very valuable when you're feeding guys for 8 days. That's how the Romans fed their soldiers, were raiding parties. Yes, it's a spoil. Yeah, because you bring a lot of stuff with you. You bring a lot of supplies with you. You have to bring cattle with you. You have to bring sheep, whatever else there is with you. Of course, along your route, you may steal a few. Yes, Tammy. Exactly. They're no longer on K rations, are they? I don't know what they're doing anymore in the army. That stuff lasts forever. Okay. So Jonathan goes up, kills 20 guys. Terror strikes from simply 20 deaths. Now, in modern day army, 20 guys die in a given battle. Even in a given moment in time. Does the rest of the army flee? They get terrified. Not really. It's okay. Hey, only 20? That's great. That's nothing. And yet you have presumably, probably close to a quarter to half a million people fleeing. That's a lot of people to flee. From 20 men dying. Hence the power of God. Isn't that fascinating that just that small amount can cause it? It does show the heart of Jonathan to know that this God was planning this all along. So all these men start to flee. I lost my page of my notes. Hold on a second here. So, between two men, they killed, presumably all 20 were just Philistines, although we had mentioned earlier that Israelites are part of this Philistine army. I don't know for sure, but I doubt Israelites were in this particular raiding party. Just a hunch. So, 20 guys killed, the army starts to flee, Saul sees what's going on. He's starting to notice what's happening. Something's happened inside the Philistine camp, which is a fairly large camp. Here comes Saul's odd actions, to say the least. Note, he knew that this was not just spontaneously created by God. Huh. Is that correct? That's an obvious statement. He knew God, the Philistines were just arbitrarily just attacking each other. He knew that something had happened. He even believed it happened in his camp, his 600 guys. And instead of talking to God, as he should have done, he stopped it. Saul unfortunately made too many mistakes, which is a little frustrating. Because he is a very talented individual. But he notices something is happening. He says, all right, take account. He knows that Jonathan and his armor bearer are gone. He calls the ark up, and then when the noise gets loud enough, he says, oh, never mind, let's just go ahead and attack. You know, sounds great. Not the best move. You see, Philistines will kill themselves whether I do it now in this battle or I wait 4 minutes and do it in 4 minutes. Because God's the one who's fighting. This is, maybe it's erroneous, but most commentators talk about this particular act of Saul's and say this is one of his blunders which caused the later problem with Jonathan and the eating of the blood and everything else. Had he consulted God, they believe God would not have told him to just kill the Philistines and don't touch the food, which would have prompted the whole do not eat. Because God only did that twice. Once for Jericho when God fought. And once again he said, just kill everything. Don't eat it, just kill everything. Only 2 times he ever does that. So, they criticized Saul for this move. Had he asked God, it's commonly believed, God would have said, yes, go, kill, and take the spoils. But he didn't. Saul acts on his own. And unfortunately, when you act on your own, you usually come to erroneous results. earlier in chapter 13, Saul did the correct thing. Back when Samuel came and Samuel said, look what you've done, you didn't wait for me like you were commanded. Saul apologized, but he gave an excuse. Samuel said, I will have nothing to do with this, and Samuel leaves. What would the normal thing for most commanders with 600 men left do? God's in love with me. I'll do something different. I'm going to abandon this endeavor. But Saul didn't. He did the right thing on his own at this point. To this point, he says, no, I'm going to stick this out. I'm going to stand here. I'm going to stand here and fight with only my 600 men, which is what he was supposed to do. Samuel didn't tell him to do it, but he made the right call at that moment in time, which is great. From that point forward, though, makes bad calls. Because Samuel's not guiding him anymore. Samuel guided Saul during the battle of Nash, with Nash, the snake from Ammon. He helped him. He told him what God wanted him to do. And Saul obeyed. Hence, Saul has the Ark of the Covenant because he needs guidance. He's not being guided anymore, though. God isn't guiding him, as it quite clearly states. God didn't guide him. Samuel wasn't around to guide him. He's using a second-rate high priest. He's using the Ark of the Covenant there, but it's not talking to him because he's not talking to the Ark. He's not talking to God. He's on his own at this point. Saul's not talking to God anymore, and God's not talking back to him. Tough place to be. You will make mistakes. Hence, he did. He makes these options and says, all right, let's go ahead and forget talking to God right now. Let's just go kill. But nobody's allowed to eat. Where did that come from? Why would he have done such a thing? Why didn't he just say, go off and kill and take the plunder, like we do at every other battle for the past 372 years? Jericho they didn't, but everybody else in the battle they did. Why would Saul make this choice? Maybe he's flying blind. Yes, Tammy.
He's trying to make nice with God by recreating Jericho.
Trying in many ways, you're absolutely right. Why, look a little bit into that. Because where is he?
You're Jericho.
He's in Jericho. He's at Gilgal, right where the launching pad was to attack Jericho and wipe it out. Great place to start. They're trying to be at one with God. He's trying to create that at oneness. You can't create. Only God can. God didn't dictate to create the at oneness. Because Saul wasn't at one with God anymore. He can't create something that isn't there, and yet he still tries to create it anyway. By commanding the people not to eat, what did it result in?
Battle fatigue.
What do you think they did? They traveled from Gilgal, was Mishmash, and they traced him over to pronounce it right. Aiyalon. That's not that far of a distance.
But
you are walking. But that's not what you could do if you were being fed. This is actually from Mishmash to whatever that's called. It's about 15 or so miles, which is not easy, but you're in battle, and you're most likely running, which is also hard. Now, if you're not eating at the same time, guess what happens when you reach there? You stop. You faint. You can't eat anymore. You can't do anything. You're too exhausted. Now, had you been eating, as all Joshua's men did, when they went to battle, they ate. Well, instead of Jericho, but they didn't really fight too much in that particular battle. So, they all ate. And what happened when they ate? Well, we remember the stories. They were able to take off in single days. Huge amounts of men and from the Canaanites just took them all out and ran away. But yet here, they were only able to travel 15 miles and stop. Now, mind you, there was 600 men at Gilgal. But by this point in time, it says all these rights for that were in the army as well as those that were hiding came out to fight too. So some of them, guess where they live at? Nearby. Hiding. They have shorter distances to travel, but yet they still can't eat. it almost seems like it's Saul was illogical choice to choose the one thing time which you don't want to prevent your army from doing what they can do is when they're so hopelessly outnumbered, you don't want them to, you want them to succeed. He is flying blind. Yes, Tammy.
In a way, did you see it as he is trying to force God's hand? Like, I'm going to weaken my men to the point of near exhaustion, mental and physical exhaustion.
Right.
So you have no choice.
You have to help.
But to fight because these men
can't do it anymore.
Can't do it anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. Which you almost, well, didn't Jonathan do the same thing? Well, no, Jonathan didn't do the same thing. Jonathan was not foolish. I mean, he knew better than that. You don't weaken your one asset you have when you have the opportunity to do something which is right. So unfortunately, Saul did make a mistake in this one. He should have consulted that ark. Hopefully it would have produced some answer, because by the way, at this point in time when he was asking, when he could have consulted it, no one committed any crime. No one committed any sin. And Jonathan didn't commit a sin yet. So God would have theoretically answered it. Unlike when he did later, when he asked later, and by that time the sin already occurred. So nothing bad had occurred yet. He could have talked to God, and God probably could have given a straight-up answer. Say, hey, you will go do this, whatever it happens to be. He didn't. He went on his own judgment. He made a bad call. Now, it's not just one bad call. He makes a couple of them, unfortunately. Verse 24. Well, it goes a little bit to 25, too. My little book here. Okay, so he says, cursed be the man who shall eat food until evening or till sunset, when I shall avenge my enemies. So the entire people did not taste food. Now he specified that till I avenge my enemies. Now this is technically God's enemies, and it's Israel who's avenging them. But as king, he is allowed to speak to them, so there's nothing abnormal about him personalizing a particular battle. That's perfectly acceptable. And he is also allowed to make such a decree that no one is to eat. He's allowed to do that as a king. And guess what happens? When you are under ban, created by a man, that is unto death if you violate it, there is a law about that in Leviticus. Let's go read the consequences. Which unfortunately did not obey these consequences. Big shock there. Leviticus 27 specifies that no person, chapter 27, verse 29, no person under a ban, this is by ban created by man, who may become doomed to destruction among men, shall ever be redeemed, but shall surely be put to death. So it's a ban created by man, because you're to death under man. You will be put to death. You cannot be redeemed. You cannot get out of it. So Saul creates a ban, which has a death consequence. Which, you know, we think, well, there are only so many laws you're allowed to break that require death. Most of them are not death laws. But human beings need to watch what they say. Those of you who recall, we go through the Torah, it says, you know, when a woman speaks and she says, pronounces some, I think, an oath. Her father must undo the oath, or her husband must undo the oath for a short period of time, else it must stand. Remember Jephthah, when he came back, when he battled, he said, whatever first comes and greets me, I will dedicate to God. And what happened? His daughter comes out. And he's grieving. Why? He made an oath. And the oath must be followed through, because you invoked the name of God doing it. You don't get to get out of that. It's an, oops, sorry God, I changed my mind. It doesn't work that way. If you change your mind, that's okay. Die now and God will deal with you later. Your consequences don't disappear because you changed your mind. It doesn't work that way. We have laws about it. So, of course, Jonathan, having no knowledge, presumably, of the law about banning not eating food, he's exhausted. He killed 20 men and probably still fought in the battle continuing thereafter. I'm sure he's very tired, needs something. He's probably weary, not necessarily unto death, but he's very weary. He reached out and grabbed some nectar. Now, whether it's honey or just oozing from a plant, we don't really know. But he tastes it. He didn't eat a whole lot. So he tasted it. He ate a small amount. It lit him up. And then everybody else pointed out, you're not allowed to do that. Now, some have argued, well, could Jonathan not see that nobody else was eating this nectar? They're all walking past it.
And he sees that no one's reaching out. He didn't figure it out. He couldn't ask, how come no one's leaving this thing? And reach out. That's an argument which I don't really necessarily buy. But the point that Jonathan probably could have asked somebody, what's going on? But he didn't. I wouldn't fault him for that, because if I was in his shoes, having killed the many people, I probably wouldn't be asking too many questions either. I'd be more interested in taking care of my needs. But as I mentioned earlier, ignorance of the law. Does that mean you're immune to it? Unfortunately, no, it's not. You don't get to be immune because you don't know something. Yes, leniency can be given, but you're not immune from the law. And unfortunately, Leviticus is very clear, you shall not be redeemed. You cannot recover. You cannot come out of this particular ban when it means to destruction, which means to death. You don't get that option in this particular type of law. Now, there are a lot of laws which you can have leniency on. This particular type of law is not one that is lenient, not meant to be lenient. So Jonathan's response in 27, my father has distressed the land. Seeing my eyes have lit up when I taste just this nectar, surely had the people eaten of the spoils of their enemy, they would have acquired, and they would not now have been even a greater blow to the Philistines. Yes, it would have been, of course. So they went to Ahalon. Now, of course, finally Saul says, okay, let's go to battle, let's take them up. But the second-rate high priest says, wait a minute, at least talk to God once before you finish this. And that's when, of course, we find the story, of course, the casting of the lots. Now, Saul already knew about two sins at this point in time when he asked the casting of the lots. One, he knew about the sin of his sacrifice, him doing something that Samuel was supposed to do. So he could be at fault here. He doesn't know for sure if it is. Two, he knew about the sin of the people eating the blood, which is completely not allowed. By the way, they were so hungry, but then evening did come, they didn't bother trying to properly kill an animal. They started to slaughter and eat it. Not allowed. They didn't do that either. So Saul's command actually caused, indirectly, the people to sin. And of course, it also caused Jonathan to sin. Not wise on Saul's part. So he knows of the two. So he divides himself and his son over here and the rest of people to identify. Is it with the people regarding, is it the sin that they just did with the eating of the blood? Is that the problem? It wasn't. So, okay, now Saul's down to, it's either my sin from the sacrificing of the animals inappropriately, or something my son did. So he separates the two of them. And he points out, even if it's amongst my son, we will still kill him. Meaning I won't show partiality to anyone. And of course, identified to Jonathan, then Jonathan says, yes, I ate of this food. Now, somebody mentioned, why did Jonathan not just pop up and say, hey, I did this earlier? Yes, Tammy.
Well, Jonathan might have been in the same boat as Saul, not knowing for sure which one it was.
That's very true. Whether or not Jonathan believed this was a legitimate sin, it wasn't a sign of ignorance. Maybe he believed it was not, or it was not a justifiable sin. Why volunteer something when you find out it's not you, or what the problem? Last thing you want is, I did something wrong, they kill you, oops, that wasn't one God was discussing, he was worried about something else. Now you have a whole other sin to deal with that you killed the wrong guy. So that's a whole other ball of wax you don't want to get into. So, Jonathan didn't volunteer, he had no reason to volunteer. He doesn't know if it's him. It might be, but it might not be. And it could still be Saul's sin with regard to the sacrifice of the animals without Samuel around. Maybe that's what God was upset with. No one knows, hence why they cast lots. And then advise Jonathan, of course, then he brings out, says, yes, this is what I did. I'm ready to die for it. Now, he didn't argue, but I didn't know. You didn't read that, right? There's no statement that says, but I had no idea. I was just totally uninformed because I wasn't even near when you proclaimed this, that I shouldn't be punished for this. Notice there was no argument. Why not? Why didn't he say, but I didn't know?
He knew the law.
He knew that there are rules. Justifiable or not, a decree was made, and he violated it. A decree that is punishable by death. He violated it. He stuck. It's okay, I'll die. Now, and Saul says, okay, it's okay. even though he's my son, I'll go ahead and kill him. Of course, now the people rise up. So, wait a minute. Jonathan is responsible for all of this. He started the battle. He, for all practical purposes, ended it. And that he started it with killing the governor. He ended it by attacking the Philistines and allowing them to start slaughtering themselves. And then allowing all the rest of Israel to come to their aid and kill more of them. So he's responsible for the success of the day. How can you kill the man who's responsible for the success? Well, technically, God's responsible for the success. Whether Jonathan was there or not doesn't make much difference. And Saul, I believe, knew that. And I went, no, yes, Jonathan did what he did, but God's the one who dictated what happened in the battle. Saul just didn't talk to God like he should have, like he could have. It would have helped a lot, in my opinion. So although Jonathan was right in that it would have been probably a greater victory of the Philistines, he still knows the consequences, and he's still willing to pay them. But this is the problem. The people rise up and say, wrong page here. Verse 30-45. Shall Jonathan die, he who achieved this great salvation for Israel? Not allowed. It will not happen. As the Lord lives, not a hair of his head should befall the ground, for he's acted on God's sake for this day. So the people redeemed Jonathan, and he did not die. Now, we just read Leviticus. You don't get redeemed. You're not allowed to be redeemed. So, we have a mistake from Saul. We have another mistake from Jonathan. And another mistake from all the people eating blood. And yet another mistake from redeeming Jonathan. We make this whole comment, two wrongs will make a right. Well, how many negatives does it take to make a right? A lot of mistakes. Is any of it right? No, none of it was right. Saul should have talked to God. Saul shouldn't have made that decree. Jonathan shouldn't have had to have made that mistake. The people shouldn't have had to eat the blood. Whose lesson was it? Saul's. All people made the mistakes back because Saul was flying blind. He didn't talk to God ahead of time. He was doing it on his own. Frustrating to see. Because he's not a bad guy. Saul's not an evil man. He tries to do what's right. He just makes more mistakes than he should. Yes, Ellie.
When you say the words, God really does hear them, and maybe a while, but Saul, Jonathan did die with Saul.
Yes, he does.
And just like Rachel, when they said, whoever's got it, death to him, she didn't die then.
She died later.
She died untimely. Both Jonathan and Rachel died untimely. The words are written.
It will happen. It will happen. Yep. Yep, it was virtually immediate, relatively immediate as far as how we would look at things. You're right. And by the way, the men mentioned at the end of this chapter, as far as Saul's sons, save one wasn't mentioned, all of them died with Saul. Yes.
Later on, David unknowingly pronounced a sentence himself when he's in front of the prophet.
Yep. Yeah. David pronounced his own sentence upon himself when Nathan comes to him about what's his name's wife? I can't think of the... Yeah, and what's his... Uriah, thank you. Uriah's wife. And, of course, results in David's son being killed, or dying from it. She's right. Just because God may not honor a decree at that moment in time doesn't mean he won't honor it at all. It just means he might postpone it. But yeah, Jonathan did eventually die. Right or wrong, he'd eventually die. Yes, Susan.
You can just see the hand of God, though, in just like the circumstances with Eli and his sons. He's bringing the end to the high priesthood. Here he's bringing an end of Saul and Saul's line, mm-hmm. because it's his plan. He's going to begin again.
Yeah, it continues to restart. Right. Continue to restart.
Both the high priesthood and the kingship.
Yep, both get cleansed. It's the same process. No, he starts the high priest, his own house first. Which is a great analogy there, before he goes to leadership and the rest of the people. Okay, so before I conclude here, I know I kept you a few minutes over time, I apologize for that. Oh, and of course, the end result, all the spoils the Israelites could have taken, they weren't allowed to. They had to go home. They all went home. They didn't go off and continue to plunder all night like Saul had planned. Clearly because of his mistake, because of Jonathan, because of the false redeeming, not allowed, but it did anyway. God never gave him an answer to say, go and take the spoils. So they all went home. The Philistines lived to fight another day. At least whoever survived the original battle. Disappointing end to a wonderful beginning. There's a lot of things I didn't cover in the previous chapter, but I won't cover them today either because it just takes too much time. One of the things I'd like to point out, that though this does appear to be a sin, it is technically not. Verse 33 and 34, when Saul says, bring a rock, a large rock, and we'll slaughter the animals here, creating a sacred pillar is not allowed, strictly forbidden by death penalty in Book of Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 22, you are not to create pillars. Some would argue, well, this is not a pillar because he's taking the people, he's sacrificing them in front of God on a rock. That's a pillar. It's not a sacred pillar. It wasn't worshiping the rock. It's just a place to do it at. Because you are to slaughter an animal, you need to pour out the blood, usually on the ground. There is no high priesthood anymore. There is no temple. So some of the rules, you would normally slaughter animals in front of a high priest or in front of a temple in the procedures, don't occur when the temple doesn't exist. Yes, Shannon.
I thought that the tabernacle and the temple were only for the animals shot as sacrifice, and that you could...
On your own, you're allowed to do as you need.
Right.
On your own, you're allowed to do as you need. Since the temple wiped out, if you do sacrifice an animal, in God's sake, technically on your own, you're allowed to do so. But in this particular case, he says it's all built an altar, which, depending on what you do on that altar, dictates what the altar is used for. Now, because the altar Saul did it previously in Gilgal, and he slaughtered the animal, and one was complete burnt sacrifice. That is a temple occurrence. He did it on his own, unallowed. This is the case, as far as for all practical purposes, appears that Saul did the slaughtering, not the high priest or whoever was around. So he would have done the same thing again. If he burnt an animal on the altar completely, he again violated the principle he did just the day earlier with Samuel, not allowed to do. Maybe he learned his lesson, I don't know. But he did build an altar. Yes, it was a slaughtering of the animal. It's difficult to say exactly what all was done with each animal. Hard to know. By the way, the point is, it's not a sacred pillar. It could be looked like one because you're slaughtering a whole bunch of animals on it, and it's one rock, but it's not a sacred pillar. It's not actually classed in that category. Just in case you're curious whether that was allowed or not, yes, it is allowed. It's not necessarily a problem.